Hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of Web3. On this episode, I speak with Yugvir. Yugvir recently completed research as part of his master's program at Georgia Tech, all around digital credentials and the future of work and digital badging. We get deep into what it means to digitally badge, the implications for informal learning, and how colleges can be part of this ecosystem. You're not going to want to miss this one, so stay tuned. But first, a word from our sponsors.
This episode is sponsored by BAF. BAF stands for the Blockchain Acceleration Foundation, and they are a 501c3 nonprofit organization dedicated to accelerating the development and adoption of Web3. BAF hosts networking and educational meetups and supports blockchain clubs at universities worldwide. BAF's sponsors and supporters include NEAR and the Algorand Foundation, who help BAF launch more educational activities. To learn more, follow the Blockchain Acceleration Foundation on Twitter.
Are you sick of expensive classes that don't help you in today's competitive work environment? EduCoin was too. So we built a decentralized learning management system that allows any teacher to host an open access industry-sponsored class. If you're a teacher and want to learn more about how you can build the class of the future, or a student looking to grow your career, visit educoin.store to see how they are helping students, teachers, and employers connect to make a more healthy secondary education ecosystem.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Web3 podcast. Today on the show, we have Yugvir. He's a builder out of Georgia Tech who I met through a number of connections in the Ed3 space. So without further ado, go ahead and introduce yourself, Yugvir.
Hey, thanks so much, Jake. It's wonderful being here. And yeah, so I'm Yugvir Prahar. I am a graduate student here at Georgia Tech in the MSCI program, and that's the Master's in Human-Computer Interaction program. So I work at Georgia Tech with C21U, the Center for 21st Century Universities, and we do a lot of work in educational technologies and just making sure that we're testing out new platforms, new credentialing, digital certificates, and a lot of new educational things and a lot of new educational technologies that we can then enforce and just make full use of so that they can match their full potential in higher education institutions. So I think Jake and I, we met when I was sharing my research on the Digital Credentials Consortium community call. And there, I just shared my research on employer perspectives and how we can basically use digital credentials in the workforce and what the barriers are for employers to adopt these digital credentials.
Yeah, so tell everyone that's listening that doesn't know, what is the Digital Credential Consortium? I think in Web3, a lot of people are thinking that NFTs and POAPs can kind of be an unlock potentially for like proof of chain, proof of work that's in an open database. But I often explain to people that this isn't actually a new idea, that there's a lot of research and there's a lot of thought behind this and even products out there. So tell me a little bit about what the DCC does, who they're partnered with, and kind of how that works.
Yeah, for sure. So the DCC is a group of 12 universities from North America and Europe, and they're working on building an ecosystem that supports trustworthy storing and verification of credentials and sharing them amongst academic institutions. So think of your transcripts that you get, but in a way more granular form, which highlights all of the skills you have. It highlights all of the achievements you've had throughout the course of your studies, and then it can be shared amongst, well, anyone, but right now the infrastructure is only for different academic institutions. And what I'm working on is the Learner Credential Pilot with the DCC. And what they do is make sure that the institutions have all of the infrastructure set up and getting to know what kinds of needs are that need to be supported for all of these different institutions so that they can issue digital credentials to students. And then the second part of that is making sure that these credentials are verifiable by employers, because the most important part for students is not just sharing these credentials amongst different academic institutions for, let's say, a master's program or a PhD program, but also sharing these with employers. And what my work does is figuring out the perspectives and barriers of where we can where employers fall into the digital credential space. Do they trust these credentials? How can we build value for the employers, but also running pilots within the institution to figure out different infrastructures and frameworks of how we can issue these credentials?
Gotcha. So, have you used any of these credentials, or what was your experience prior to joining the program? Are you always passionate about this, or?
Yeah. So actually, before joining the program, I didn't really know much about any of these credentials. I came across a credential called Block Certs, and that was the first time that Georgia Tech had issued any sort of digital credential to students. Before that, it was just PDFs of or certificates of achievement, but not really a verifiable digital credential. And they started with the Iceberg program, which was just an intercultural program for credited and non-credited students, just to get to know about opportunities in STEM and just to get to know different cultures. It was kind of like a DEI program that you can get this credential for. And that's where I got familiarized with digital credentials and built that just built more interest in me for those. And I reached out to C21U and Jana, who was my PI, then introduced me to this whole other realm of the work that they were doing and the pilots that they were building just within the program. So after that, I got introduced to the program management certificate course, and I'm a UX researcher by trade and more on the UX side of things instead of building digital credentials. So they onboarded me to figure out how we can make these systems more usable, not just for students, but also for instructors, and then eventually how we can get these credentials to employers.
Gotcha. Very cool. So, as you kind of go down this, I also am a UX researcher, and I also have kind of been fascinated by, credentials. What problems do you think it solves? Because I think the first step in UX research is always to find the problem. I think people think they have problems, and often what they think is the problem, what actually is the problem, might not even be the same. So that's where we kind of have to start. So what problems does this solve? Is it that people that go to Georgia Tech don't have granularity in their programs they attend? Is it that Georgia Tech wants to offer things and track their outcomes? What do you think these problems that it's solving are really at its core?
You got it right. So the problem that it solves is a lot of students didn't really have proof of the skills they had earned. So they wanted a little bit more from the traditional transcripts that they already had, right? The transcripts, let's say I do a program here at Georgia Tech, my eventual transcript tells me I did something in software engineering and I did a course in software engineering, but it doesn't really say what skills I learned, right? It doesn't really say I learned Python. It doesn't say I learned JavaScript or all of the different tools that I'm using. It doesn't say what level of proficiency I have with all of these different tools. So the employers then have to go back and interview me for five different rounds just to make sure that I have those skills and assess all of those things. What this solves is it bridges that gap of assessments from employers and also the skills that students earn. So instructors can, to the best of their abilities, issue these credentials with a more granular skill structure and a more granular experiences attached to those skills, so that students have more confidence in the skills that they have. They have documentations of the skills that they have. And it's just easier for instructors to go back in and match those skills with the opportunities that they have, and easier for employers as well to just match students with the opportunities that they have. So that's one problem it solves. The second thing is why it's important that it's verifiable is that in we're growingly more and more digital now. Our identities are a lot more digital as well. Most of the things we have or own or host are also living in the digital space. So a lot of institutions for years now, over 10 years, I think, have been issuing digital transcripts and digital certificates of just graduation and digital diplomas. So with that comes a lot of fraud as well. So making sure that these credentials that we issue are more verifiable and self-sovereign solves that problem of fraudulent skills, fraudulent credentials, fraudulent certificates. And this is more of a problem on this is more of a need for the employer side and just a verification side of things. So even when you go to a new graduate school, they have to verify all of your other transcripts. If you're moving between schools from maybe a lesser known community college to another institution, it reduces the effort taken to verify all of the skills. It reduces the effort taken to verify your transcripts, the classes you went to. It's basically like a reference in and of itself, right? And another...
So one thing I want to just kind of stop on there. I think that early on in my research, when I was starting my company, one of the big things I thought was important was verification, right? And proof of work. And I found that quickly there was kind of a disconnect, right? Because if you go to someone who works in even Web 2 as a programmer, they're like, well, you know, I don't think many people have degrees or a degree's been a requirement for a while. I use GitHub and then my code gets reviewed and scrubbed and it's pretty seamless. I could go to a boot camp, I could go to whatever. It's just the quality of my GitHub gets checked and that's how I apply for jobs. But most jobs aren't like that, right? I mean, small software engineer is a small percentage of things. And even software engineering, right? It's like if you're an American software engineer and you already have the college prereq, sure, it probably works like that. Or even if you don't, you might have a prototype portfolio to kind of show. But an international engineer, it becomes much trickier, you know, because it's like, is this actually your code? You know, can I trust you? How annoying is payment going to be? So, you know, what's kind of been your feedback or review from the communities that one, you know, think verification might be, you know, not needed, like in the case I kind of just described where you can check the GitHub or the portfolio, and then two, where it's like we're not really verifying, you know, for a customer service role. I don't know how you would even verify, you know, work or if that would be needed. I guess kind of what have you seen there? Is that a common complaint you've heard as well?
Yeah, so that is a common issue I've heard of as well, that, oh, we don't really need to verify, right? We have all of these systems already in place. It works super well for us. We get this person on board, we interview them, and that's it. But on the other hand, there are other groups and communities that really do appreciate this value of verifying things. So like you said, the example of international students, things don't always translate. So in India, just your grade point averages are not even out of 4, right? They're out of 10. So the way you get graded, the way you get evaluated is fully different than what you might have in the US. So even for higher education institutions to check back with their earlier transcripts and their earlier work, it's a lot of work. And it's honestly a lot of human work that it takes. It takes a lot of human eyes to go through things, make sure that they're kind of matching with people. Because in the software industry, yes, you can write code, you can write bots to go and scrub the GitHub and figure out whether it matches your criteria or not. But in other industries, like program management, let's say, all that matters is your experience and your soft skills and the work that you've done. And there isn't always a physical proof of the work that you do. It's more your team leading and team management things. And that's where people and employers found a lot more value for this, because they wanted to see those kinds of works in these credentials. So another thing where Web3 comes in is that with new transitions of, or with new iterations of these digital credentials, you can keep adding not just granular skills, but also attach experiences to them, be that in the forms of your PDFs or other things, right? Or your reports or anything else. But it's still very self-contained and the proof is all there. So if an employer wants to go back in and check whether this person has these soft skills that they're talking about, team management, team leading, then they can go in and check that just from the credential itself. They don't have to spend a lot of time figuring out whether this person really led a team of 5 people, whether this person really had an impact on this team of, let's say, 20 people, whether this person really did have 15% increase in seat leads. So that's where matters so, more.
You know, I've been on the hiring end before, and I hired up to 10 people last year for the startup I'm running. You know, we've obviously been hit by some of the recent downturns, but we still got a team, and it's been good. Most of the hires really did work out. I think hiring is something that you can learn and get better at. But from my perspective as an employer, one of the things I was looking at was just, you know, is there a bare minimum of skills? Like, for example, for hiring a front-end engineer or UX designer, can they use Figma? Can they code in this language? And then from there, it's like the rest is just going to be personality, drive, work ethic, like those things. And I'm not even really reading the resume, because I feel like you qualify those things just in an interview. It's the same thing, you know, where the, and it becomes problematic, obviously, when you're international, there's a language barrier, it becomes tougher to assess those things. But I didn't have time, I guess, from what I'm saying. Like, I spent 10, 15 seconds, you know, reviewing a resume. And most companies don't even do that, right? Like, I read everyone that applied to my company. Most companies are going to screen out 75%. I think that was a quote from one of the prominent CEOs in the in one of these job board spaces companies. They screen out 75% automatically, right? And then 25% get read, and the read is like 10%, and then you're in this 1 hour interview. And that's kind of how it goes, unless you have a recruiter in the middle. It's a little bit different. But how do we get people to actually read these credentials? Like, from my perspective, I would love, obviously, to click on a credential, see the front end you built, you know, see the stack. But I don't have time to do that 100 times. I only have time to do that for the best three people. So how do you view that in working in that ecosystem, like, practically?
No, that makes a lot of sense. So the two things that we found that employers mostly wanted was one, matching the skills of the job just directly to this pool of candidates. So you can have an infrastructure where you have a pool of candidates. They all have these credentials, different skills, different achievements. But the job requires five top skills. So matching those people with these five skills, and then just from there, using that as a method to scrub out all of the other, basically all of the other candidates that you don't really that don't really fit the job, right? So a pool of candidates with one platform, that's a solution that a lot of people kind of wanted, because it solves their problem of exactly that. They don't really look at resumes. They don't really have to compare all of these. The system is doing that for them. They have people with these skills that they can use for the next round. Now, if it's a big company like let's say LinkedIn, Coca-Cola, they have thousands and thousands of applications, and within those thousands of people, there's still going to be at least hundreds of people who do match the minimum skills requirements. So how would the recruiters go in after that stage when the minimum requirements are met, but they still want more from these people, right? They can't go out and look at each resume and call people. So that's where this comes in handy, because not just the skills are on the credentials, but also the experience and the total number of hours that this person has with this particular skill can also be mapped to that skill because of the experiences that they have. It can also be housed in that credential. So it just adds more granular layers to their experiences and their skills, and can just give the employers and the HR extra filters to actually go back in and see which people have the most experience with said skills. Does that make
Yeah,
sense?
so you know how I've been approaching my company is essentially someone within the org, whether it's HR or even just someone that does the job already, almost seems like they need to vet the credential, and then the credential then becomes a prerequisite checkbox, right? So it's like, you know, I've already reviewed this credential and like what's going to probably be behind it, and now it's kind of a fast pass, you know, to getting an interview or to a job here or a promotion. Is that kind of in alignment with what you're seeing? Because I don't see another way really to use it as a screening tool unless you kind of get consensus between the hiring agent and the educator who issues the credential.
Yeah, so in our case, what we're doing is that we already do have that consensus within the educator and the hiring agent, because we're only working with industries that are partnered with us. So both of them align on how the credential was evaluated, how the skills were given out, and what the basic evaluation criteria was for those skills. So you're right. In our small ecosystem and piloting ecosystem, those two already align on the kinds of skills and the evaluation methods that they're proposing. So it works well as a screening tool in that aspect. The second thing that then comes into question is, if we go forward as collectively in the world, if we go forward with digital credentials as a way of showing skills and achievements, then there needs to be a framework for those skills, because everyone needs to agree upon the same sort of language to be able to make sure that it's all standardized, right, across all of the industries. And that's something that we haven't yet gotten to. There's potential to get to a similar language of skills and frameworks, and a lot of people are doing this work. In the biotech industry, I remember there was Angela. She heads the biotech. I can go back in and check the name, but she has her own startup where they issue digital credentials for very standardized practices of the biotech industry. So operations, pipette functioning, how to use a DNA separator or strainer, or just things like that. But they have very regulated procedures for those. So it's easier for her in the biotech industry to issue these credentials because there's the same language and there's the same framework. And the industry, the people in the industry, the hiring managers, they agree with these skills. And the issuers, Angela and her team, as a secondary issuer of these credentials and verifier, can then issue these credentials. And that drives the value because everyone agrees on those kinds of skills. So until we have a big framework or a common framework of these skills in the larger industries, it's going to be hard to use that as a screening
agent.
Yeah,
I mean, I think the everyone agrees thing is the hardest part of this now because, right, like, you know, I'm a UX researcher, right, at Walmart, and you know, you I'm sure will start a career here once you graduate at another company, and I know tons of other UX researchers, right? I'm part of communities on LinkedIn and whatnot, and we have conferences, so in many ways we're very similar, but obviously the last, you know, 5-10% of our UX research DNA is probably different, and our job titles and descriptions are probably different from company to company. What, you know, Walmart considers an advanced UX researcher versus Google might not be the same. I think some ways AI can be an aid to this, right? Because it's really good at matching and recognizing patterns in language. So it could maybe help with that, correct some syntax, kind of do some legwork there. But also, I almost wonder if, like, it's a little hopeless to try and figure out what is the underlying skills or pathway of job XYZ, right? Because I don't know if everyone needs to agree on it, or if it's just we need to get the people within certain ecosystems to agree on it, right? So if, like, you're a Georgia Tech and Georgia Tech is a feeding program from Northrop Grumman, they need to have alignment, and the students have to have alignment that you're getting fed skills that Northrop Grumman endorses, but not necessarily Google. I mean, there might be a consensus there, and there should be a pathway, obviously, for Google and Northrop Grumman to hire from the same talent pool. But I feel like that it's almost like these micro communities need to form, or ecosystems, rather than one massive. But I guess, is that in conflict with what you were saying, or is that kind of aligned?
So, in a practical sense, you're absolutely right. It does align with what I'm saying. Having these micro industries and aligning on the same types of job roles is kind of the way forward, and is kind of what people or what we're seeing right now. Like Angela's startup, it's doing super well because it's using the micro industry and leveraging the micro industry for digital credentials, right? The second thing that comes up with that is, yes, micro industries can be used, but then there are so many different kinds of issuing authorities and so many different kinds of people who are issuing these credentials. It can be a third party who's issuing credentials, but it can also be, let's say, Georgia Tech who's issuing these credentials. And then what comes up is the trust aspect, more human trust aspect rather than just machine trust. Do I, as an employer, trust this third party startup, or do I trust Georgia Tech more, or do I trust this other self-contained credential that I don't know who is issuing, but we know that the skills are valid, right? So am I hiring people based on just the name of the issuing authority, or am I hiring them on the skills? That's the more deeper meta question here. I don't know what you think about that.
You know, I think for me, the skills part, I've read so much recently about the skills-based economy, right? I keep coming back to the fact that hard skills is definitely what a lot of people hire for, but it's not what gets you the job, I think, because because, you know, whether you are advanced at JavaScript or not is obviously super important to being a successful software engineer, but can you solve a business problem and work on teams? And, you know, culturally, are you a fit? And, you know, those are really important too. Some companies want you to come to an office. Some companies want you to understand the basics of healthcare policy in the U.S. Some companies want you to be a U.S. citizen. There's a lot more than skills that factor into it. And also, you'll be forced to learn skills. I know at my company, we hired a front engineer. She started working on an Angular project. Then she did some WordPress for us. Then she did some React. And now she's working Remix. I know she's going to be able to keep thriving and being successful because she's someone that will just kind of figure it out and kind of, you know, it doesn't, you know, it's where if I hire a smart contract developer off Discord, they can write a checklist of skills they have, like programming languages. But as soon as you kind of ask them to do something opaque or make a pivot, because they're a contractor, because there's a language barrier, and because they've kind of hyper-focused on those skills, there's problems. Because I don't think they truly understand what you're building, nor do they feel comfortable sometimes contributing and making changes and, like, giving me feedback, you know, which, you know, might be a cultural thing or might just be, like, kind of the problem with contractors in some ways. Is, you know, you have a set contract. So I think that that was not the most direct answer, but I think that that's my nuanced answer.
No, that makes complete sense. So, and what you're saying is that it's not just the hard skills that get people the job, right? It's a lot of different experiences. And right now, what kind of drives that trust that this person might also have these different experiences is the issuing authority, is the places that they've worked at. If they've worked at Facebook, a bigger team, smaller team, Google, it's all of that metadata of their experiences, right? That kind of lends you to believe, oh, this person is from Georgia Tech, so they have had a rigorous training and they've worked in team projects or any other preconceived notions that you might have about that. So the aspect that's building trust with employers, it is not just those skills, is also the name of the issuing authority, which is in direct tension with the purpose of digital credentials and decentralizing all of these skills and having a person be judged on just the skills and only showing the information important enough for a person, right? So that's kind of something that I think everyone in this space is tackling with. Until it's more ubiquitous, just like there was with digital transactions, with digital bank transfers and those kinds of things, until this technology is more ubiquitous, I don't think that the trust aspect of the issuing authority is going to go away. So I don't think that just based on skills, people are going to be hiring people. So I think tying it back to the micro industries part, a good way of building trust or more dissemination of these credentials is to go with micro industries. And once there's more trust and these things are more ubiquitous in all different kinds of micro industries, you can start thinking about taking away aspects of who the issuing authority is and who is behind those credentials. I think, does that make sense to you?
Yeah, it does. I think that these are questions we're all working through right now. I think that anyone promising a magic bullet, you know, saying that, you know, their digital badge. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's been 50, 70 million, I think, digital badges issued now, Credly badge or all them, you know, Ether badge, whatever it is. You know, I think that there's a lot going out there. And if those badges or those certificates are doing things within their little ecosystem, if Amazon's looking at the AWS ops engineers or the other companies are, and the LinkedIn recruiters are hiring off that, that's great. But, you know, it's not going to be it's not the end all be all of hiring. It's not the end all be all of learning. So one thing I want to kind of, you know, pivot to a little bit here is just higher education in general. We're going to be a little more broad here. So we're talking a lot now about the product, right? I mean, I think the idea of a digital product is you're kind of selling the badge, right? I mean, because you come, you earn it, and that's what you get at the end of education. It's one of the most tangible things you could get, you know, because the rest of it's kind of just brain knowledge, I guess. What do you think the role of higher education is, I guess, to deliver this product or to, like, justify their value? And do you think that higher education can kind of compete with more micro programs that are, like, endorsed or valued in communities like the AWS or the IBM badges of the world. What do you think the future holds?
Yeah, so that's the basically kind of the purpose of the DCC, right? Is to make sure that eventually is to make sure that education and higher education and the things that people learn are more ubiquitous, are more equitable. So the purpose why DCC saw value in this technology is because they wanted to eventually get to a place where it doesn't matter where you're getting your education from. It doesn't even matter where you're getting your skills from. Maybe you learned them just along the course of your life. If you're an 8-year-old taking care of your grandma at home until you're 16, you have a lot of the skills that are required for nursing jobs. You have a lot of caregiving skills, right? So eventually, in a very utopian ideal stage, it's to build towards a system that doesn't recognize the things, the other criteria, how you earn these skills and how formally, informally you earn these skills, but recognizes the skill itself and recognizes your experiences itself and use that to get you jobs, to get you other places and transfer all of those skills in different industries. But the role of higher education right now, I think, is to build more trust with these credentials. So the DCC, again, has 12 institutions and they're all working in issuing digital credentials to all of their students. And they're trying to get a push on the Learner Credential Wallet app. So I'll tell you a little bit more about the Learner Credential Wallet. So it's basically an app where whoever issues credentials and as part of the DCC, that's where the credentials are stored, verified, managed, and can be shared with the public. So it can be shared on LinkedIn, it can be shared as a public link with other people, and how someone verifies whether this credential is valid or not is just clicking the link and it takes them to Verifier Plus, which is hosted by the DCC. So you know that it's legitimate and hosted by the DCC, and the credential, the JSON of the credential is pushed to the Verifier Plus, and if the skills are valid or still up to date, it says, yes, this person did go to the issuing authority, this person did go to Georgia Tech, this person did go to MIT, they did have these skills from MIT. So the purpose of having that is right now they want to build more value to these credentials. And you can almost think of it as higher education being its own micro industry, because there's a lot of communication happening in higher education itself. A lot of people work here, a lot of people work for Georgia Tech, systems engineers, researchers, other academic institutions, right? So part of the higher education, I believe, is to start using these skills, and with pilots like ours, with the industry, start getting these credentials and start getting this technology into the industry, finding pathways for these credentials into the industry so that eventually we can move towards a world where we have more trust in these credentials and where a lot of the industries are more familiar with these credentials, because all the different institutions basically do have connections and kind of are feeding different employers from different industries. So using this as a way of evaluating the skills for those industries is a great way of just making sure that everyone knows what these things are and making sure that we disseminate digital credentials so that eventually they can be used more and built upon more and meet their full potential.
Yeah. So I guess, you know, in your opinion now, what is kind of next for you, and what is next, I guess, for the industry in a tangible sense? Do you want to kind of take this research you've done and, you know, with the program that you're implementing, and do you want to, I guess, kind of take any actions or changes to it? Is it something that's inspired you to do something or open up any new programs within Georgia Tech? I guess, reflecting now, what's next?
Yeah, so actually we were just having this conversation with our C21U management. And what we're going to do next is work with the program management course here at Georgia Tech. So GTPE works with a program management course where all of the instructors are people in the industry who have been in the industry for 20 years, imparting all of their industrial knowledge relevant work styles. And as their part-time jobs, they teach at the GTPE Program Management Certificate course, which people can take and they can move forward with that. It can be accredited or non-credited course, depending on if you're an enrolled student or not. It can be a part-time course. It's super flexible. But instead of getting a degree in the end, you get these digital credentials, but also you get, in our summer pilot, what we're trying to do is getting them a pathway to the industry with these digital credentials that they earn. So not just giving students value with these digital credentials, not just giving them value in terms of all of the work that they do during these courses, all of the teamwork, all of the team leading, all of the soft skills that they earn, but also giving them a pathway to the industry with these digital credentials so that we can build more trust in them. The second thing we're doing with that is a lot of the things that we noticed in the program management role, let's say specifically, is a heavy emphasis on soft skills. So communication and teamwork, leadership skills, conflict resolution. A lot of these soft skills, the PM industry has already had frameworks to evaluate for, which is really interesting. So they have qualitative frameworks that actually teach communication and stakeholder communication as sorts of models, as active listening models, and as risk analysis models, just with communication. And it's super interesting. So just to make sure that we're also getting more out of this pilot, we're also looking at how can we evaluate for these qualitative, these more soft skills. And how does that translate to actually displaying that on digital credentials, right? How does that translate to making sure that the industry and the school are on the same page for those soft skills? So we're really looking more into how these soft skills are evaluated, communication and teamwork and team lead, and what kinds of proofs do people need to really know that these soft skills are valid. So not just frameworks of evaluation, not just for instructors, and not just for employers to understand how, let's say, communication was evaluated for a candidate or a student, but also what proof do the employers need to build trust in the fact that this person and this candidate does have valid communication skills.
Yeah, so right now, there's kind of two things I think of when I think of proof, right? So if you hire a contractor, right, generally what you do is you get like a person who's super qualified and in the area, say they're in Sri Lanka or India or Argentina, and then they basically say, oh, I train and I vet everyone that comes in, works, I'll manage the contractors, just give us the project, and you get a team of this many contractors for this many hours, and they might come on Slack and message you, but mostly you have a point of contact. So that's how they kind of, that's one way of vetting it, right? Is you kind of have like a trust network.
Yeah.
And then two, obviously, there's like the LinkedIn approach, right? Is endorsement. You go on my LinkedIn, 20 people endorse me as a leader or communicator, yada, yada, yada. What ways have you thought of to like kind of actually validate this? Like I'm a pretty social person, I would think, but maybe I have a temper or maybe I'm lazy. You don't know. How do you get people to be honest about that stuff, or how do you actually like vet that stuff, or what are the important things to vet for, and is it like tests, or is it just kind of checking their vibe? I guess what are you thinking on that front?
So we're working with the instructors on that, and they have their own framework to vet all of this stuff, which is apparently their own IP, so I can't really share how they vet it, but I can tell you how they go about vetting all of this. So with all of the time that these instructors are spending with their students, they have sets of assignments. And for a program management course, they do have to present pretty consistently, and they do have to reflect back on their own methods and reflect back on their own recordings of these presentations and see if they see their own limitations or not. Using all of that qualitative data from their own reflections, the instructors kind of go back, and just their presentation skills as well, they have checkboxes of did this person effectively communicate this, did this person effectively work in a team, and they're constantly shuffling teams and other things. So they have this complicated system of analyzing whether a person is good at communication or not. Whenever the instructors see that the person in the team is struggling, did they resolve those conflicts or not? But it's a very, very human thing right now. And these instructors are spending time with their students to analyze all of these things and say, it's up to the instructor to, at the end of the day, say, yes, I believe this person is capable of communication. Instead of 20 people endorsing it, it's more the instructor's authority that says that this person is capable of achieving the skill of communication. And why that works right now is because we're working with the industries that these instructors have worked in. So they already have their own value and their own trust in that industry. So that works with these small pathways, but it wouldn't really work overall if you're applying outs from anywhere outside.
So that's the
this.
One thing I think coming from, like, you know, someone who's pretty pro Web3, you know, there's parts of my product that live on a blockchain. Mm-hmm. You know, I kind of am like, ugh, another just like walled garden, right? Like, you know, you 10 instructors get to endorse students and get them along their path. But what about the millions and millions of other people you probably want to interact with or endorse? Or how do you kind of expand your network so that other, you know, provide, you know, issuers or verifiers can come in it? You know, I think of the Twitter model, right? You could make them pay, right? And then they get the little check mark and maybe there's some, you know, diligence done by a team. But in general, how do you view that? I guess there's, you could use AI, I guess, and quiz them, or you could do, you know, if I trust John and then John becomes part of the network. I don't know. What would you say to that?
Yeah, I think what we're trying to do is more of what you said, the trust model. If I trust John, then we can trust him, like creating that social network of proof instead of going just for direct recommendations or skills-based or having 20 people or just the institution endorse them. So what we're trying to do here is use the industry experts as a way of building that initial trust. But then once we establish that initial trust and these workers are in the industry themselves, they can go back in and reference. It's just like a word of mouth kind of reference structure, right? But in a digital form. So this person knew Rob, and Rob is a great leader, as a thought leader in this industry. And this person has a credential that's endorsed by Rob. So that should be great. That is a good way of, for the short term, building trust with just employers. But if you think long term, again, there's that tension of we don't want a centralized authority, right? We don't want an authority figure in any case. So that's something we're always struggling with. How do we make sure that we get this technology into the industry, at the same time making sure that eventually our goal is to not have the issuing authority be a function of the skill, or not have it even be present or be worthy of sharing with people, because that's more equitable in terms of education. Because that way, people who aren't going to Georgia Tech and who aren't, let's say, privileged enough to be enrolled in Georgia Tech or can also have these different skills, but and have these equal opportunities, right? But that's a very long-term utopian thing to think about, and nothing that we can get answers to quickly, ever.
Yeah, it's definitely a lot of utopian thinking at times. Well, you know, I really appreciate you coming on the show. Obviously, me and you are both doing a lot of research on this, and, you know, there's probably a need for young people, I think, to do this sort of thinking. I think that, you know, what I've seen is that people wait till they get old to think about education, because, you know, they're like, oh, how am I going to pass down my knowledge? But then, you know, technology and practical stuff, like, I don't know, probably half of the people are learning how to invest from TikTok or Twitter now. How do we include that experience into what we were just talking about? I think that the need for young people to think about education, ed tech's important and use modern tools, but also to kind of not be overzealous that they can solve these big problems overnight, which are just like healthcare, which is my previous, you know, startup before the one I'm at now. When the government's involved, when there's lots of parties involved, when it's international in some ways, it's really hard. So, anything you want to close with, promote your research, promote your next kind of thing you're working on, promote the groups you work with, anything like that?
So I just wanted to say that this utopian kind of thinking is a huge part of what the DCC is trying to do. And I'm just a very small part of what the DCC is trying to do. It's an international collaboration between 12 different research institutes and 12 different institutions. So eventually, we'll probably get there. We'll probably get to a space where everything is more skills-based and less issuing authority-based, and education is more equitable. But that was just my thoughts on the DCC. I also am currently working for my master's thesis with DoorDash, but actually, I don't know if I can share much about that anyway, so I think I'll leave that part out. But yeah, I think
Again, if people want to contact you, best way to do it, Twitter, email, what?
Yeah, so perfect. If anyone wants to contact me, my email is viperhar3@gatech.edu. That's viperhar3@gatech.edu. And just feel free to reach out to me on LinkedIn.
We'll have some show notes going. Yeah, of
thanks
course.
So much
You're always welcome. And hopefully I can share some of your research and some of the Discords and forums I'm part of, and we can share as pod. And yeah, it's good work you're doing. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, thanks so much. And just let me know whenever you publish the podcast.
And there you have it, another episode of the Web3 podcast. Thanks again for listening and for all those out there supporting us. Again, we have some huge events coming up here in April. We're going to be at Consensus, New York NFT. We're going to be recording content. So if you're interested in partnering with us, doing a collab, being on the pod, feel free to reach out to us. We're always responding on Twitter, Discord, Telegram, you name it, we got it. So again, thank you to Aloe Diva for providing the music to the show and playing us out. And as always, thank you for all that support us and our guests today, Yugvir. Have a good one out there.